No, I won't talk to you, okay? You have to stop it. I've gone to see someone. Someone help me.
Hello and welcome to Good Friends of Jackson Elias, the regular podcast about Call of Cthulhu,
horror films,
and horror gaming in general.
My name's Paul Fricker.
I'm Scott Allwood.
And I'm Matt Sanderson.
And this episode we're going to be having a media catch-up where we talk about books and films and TV that we've enjoyed recently and have something to say about. Well, I think you're kicking things off, Matt. So, yeah, what have you been enjoying?
There seems to be a little bit of a theme with some of the stuff I've been consuming over the last couple of months. I think, bizarrely, this started a while back when one of the things I do when I'm working from home is I tend to have something just playing away in the background just to give me some ambient noise. And usually I prefer things that I've either seen or heard before. So like I usually play like the same music over again. I have the same films or TV playing away so that it doesn't necessarily provide a distraction that I suddenly think, oh, I've got to watch this when I should be working, but just something to help kind of get some noise in the background. And my wall of DVDs that I have in the living room, I settled upon a box set for the five films in the Dirty Harry series. So the good old classic Clint Eastwood films set around the San Francisco area.
Mm.
And then it happens about maybe a month or two after that, I then end up thinking, I'd like to get some reading done, but Dr. Sleep, which one day I will eventually finish reading, the first half of that book I found pretty impenetrable. So I picked up another book randomly off the shelf. My wall of horror that's on the right-hand side of my desk in my office upstairs. And happened to be also a tale set around the San Francisco area. It's actually a little bit further north in this case. A place called Malaska Point. It's the first book of the quartet of books that formed the Beast House trilogy by Richard Layman. So the Cellar.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Mm.
By God, that's a pretty vile book. I wasn't expecting to be dealt with some fairly graphic sexual child abuse in the first 20 pages and then very vividly described bestiality towards the end of the book. That book, even though it's fairly short, packs a hell of a punch.
It's Richard Layman. What do you expect?
Yeah. But especially after reading The Woods Are Dark, I was maybe thinking, oh yeah, this might get a bit depraved in some parts, but yeah, that was a bit more than I was expecting.
Huh.
That was kind of his brand.
Yeah, splatterpunk, definitely. But even some of almost like the throwaway lines in that book made me chuckle with how vividly grotesque they were. You mean he's describing a penis with a mouth on the end of it? And that how it continues to perform even after having been killed while inserted into the orifice of a particularly old woman. But anyway, that's getting off topic.
I like the fact that you led into this with Dirty Harry, and then, but I'm still getting over the fact that you play films whilst you're working.
Mm.
I just can't get my head around that. Or having the TV on at all ready while you're working. I don't know. I mean, it depends what you're doing. Are you just like number crunching while you're doing that, or are you?
If I've got some fairly repetitive and not mindless tasks, but stuff that is quite formulaic, then it's stuff I just like to have there be some sound in the background while I do it.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, yeah.
Particularly design work, so particularly like when I'm laying out the Blasphemous Tome issues, having something playing away in the background is almost like a must for me there. I have to have something to break the silence otherwise.
Yeah.
So that got around to my second instance with San Francisco in as many months.
Uh-huh.
And the third one's been one that's really kind of grabbed me and is why my submission for this time's round's talk. And it's a step back in time, admittedly more in lines with Dirty Harry than it is with The Cellar. But I think I must have stumbled across this on YouTube, where someone had decided to put up the pilot episode as a standalone video. And then someone on another channel has put up all five seasons over 10 8 to 10 hour long videos encompassing all the episodes of The Streets of San Francisco.
Oh, God. God, that takes me back to my childhood. Yeah, with Carl Malden and a very young Michael Douglas.
So what's that, Matt?
It's effectively a police procedural. It's one of the many Quinn Martin production TV series that came out in the 70s. Quinn Martin, this is a bit of context, all the shows that he produced and that his company, Quinn Martin Productions, manufactured, they all followed a similar kind of format. So they all had the same kind of intro into the TV series. If it was one that was kind of, they're very episodic and have a running story throughout them, then it would just be like, here's the name of the show, a Quinn Martin production. And then tonight's guest or starring blah and blah with guest stars, blah, blah and blah. Tonight's episode, insert title here. And they all followed that kind of format, which then ended up being lampooned in hilarious fashion with the likes of Police Squad. Even to the point where they had the same announcer do the title.
Oh, nice. Yeah, yeah.
Although with Police Squad, of course, you had the title never match what the announcer said. Which I thought was a hilarious gag for me. I just find that really on brand with my type of humour.
Yeah. It only went for about 6 episodes, did it, I think?
Yeah, a total of 6. That's right. So cancelled after 4.
Terrible. Yeah.
And then 3 films.
Oh, yeah. But that was like 6-7 years later. This is really where the format of those shows came from that was lampooned so much better later on. When I say Quinn Martin, not so much The Streets of San Francisco. They hark back to an older couple of shows that, again, were police procedurals around that kind of time and slightly earlier in the 60s. But if you had other ones where they relied on a ongoing premise, things like The Fugitive, it would explain about Richard Kimball, his flight from justice to try and find the one-armed man, or The Invaders, another favourite of mine that I've been slowly getting through over the years, which is David Vincent's encounter with aliens and how no one will eventually believe him until season 2, when he gets a whole gang of people around him that finally start to believe that there is this alien conspiracy. But yeah, the premise of The Streets of San Francisco is just really simple. You've got 2 cops. You've got Mike Stone, played by Carl Malden, the kind of older mentor character who's been on the force for years and has taken in this very young, recently promoted to the homicide division, Steve Keller, played by the very young Michael Douglas. And together, they solve crimes. They work in homicide, so all of the episodes have ultimately an angle which brings in the homicide division of the San Francisco Police Department. The whole series was originally spawned from an adaptation of Carolyn Weston's Porphyria, which is a novel from 1971, 1972, that kind of time, which I think they ended up changing a lot of the character names from the book into the TV show. But ultimately, it followed a quite different format after that initial TV movie pilot that they did, that it settled into the normal Quinn Martin structure. If you had Act 1, Act 2, 3, 4, and an epilogue, of which they could never spell epilogue right on the title card, which used to wind me up something chronic. It has a U and an E at the end of it. It doesn't end in a G.
Is that the American spelling?
The Americans use both.
Ah. That used to wind me up chronically with The Invaders, because I went, how has your autocorrect not found that glaring error on every single episode? Normally, Act 1 involves the crime happening, or at least the build-up to the crime. Act 2 and 3 kind of interchange between complications and escalations that occur. And then Act 4, usually the catch-all reveal of the criminal act. And that number 5 is kind of like tying all the loose ends up in a nice little bow. And then normally ending up on a nice little happy note of clapping each other on the back and going away with a smile or a somewhat witty remark to help diffuse a little bit of the tension.
Always leave them laughing.
Yeah.
I remember watching this on TV as a kid, and it was one of my first understandings of how different, certainly in the 70s, and I think it's still the case, British and American culture are, because I was watching those around the same shows very much like those around the same time as The Sweeney was on TV. It's just chalk and cheese tonally, in that The Sweeney was more downbeat. I mean, you occasionally had upbeat endings, but more often than not, things would end on a sour note. The bad guy would get away, or someone important would die, or something would go wrong. They felt like a lot more in the way of tensions and downbeat character stuff on the way there. And the American stuff was always very upbeat and that very happy ending on each one. It was something of a revelation to me as a kid, just seeing how different the two were.
Mm.
I think this particular show kind of almost tries to straddle the gap between those two types of tonality. That it's not as grim as the likes of the Sweeney or the UK equivalents, but it definitely felt more gritty in comparison to some of the other US shows of the time that I remember seeing.
Hmm.
There's a few episodes that kind of stood out to me. At the time of recording this, I'm up to just coming up to the end of season two, so I've watched a fair number of almost like 45, 50 episodes at this point. There's a few that have stood out as being quite good to me. There's the 30-year pin. Actually, I think it's the that's the first proper episode of the series after the TV movie pilot that involves a longtime friend of Stone's being killed in a bungled robbery that pretty much was just over a small handful of change for a really trivial matter. But it kind of showed the fact of his wife coming to his bedside and gradually watching this poor cop kind of die on his deathbed. A Collection of Eagles, also from season one, that involved coin counterfeiting. So went into some quite intricate detail about how coin stamping and manufacture occurred, different types of rare coins, which is something I've been interested in and thinking of building scenarios around before anyway. For the Love of God, which involved a series of killing priests, but then there was an underlying connection between all the different victims. And the 24 Karat Plague, which is probably my favourite overall.
That's a good title.
Oh, a great one that involves a whole bunch of hijackers taking a series of what they think is just irradiated gold, but finding it isn't just gold. It also includes plutonium as well.
Oh, I remember that one. Yeah.
Yeah. So they open up this thing thinking, oh, yeah, it means well, we just have to give it a couple of days and there won't be any radiation. And no, they start opening it up and trying to melt down these coins into little planchette type things. And they're slowly getting irradiated and then dying of radiation poisoning. It's just not the kind of thing I was expecting to come up in a show like that. But yeah, it's just been a really refreshing change of watching a kind of police procedural from that time period that felt a little bit more gritty, a little bit more edgy than some of its counterparts. But the thing I've really liked about it from a kind of writing perspective is that kind of regulated structure, that having that four-act structure plus epilogue, I think could be quite handy to use, especially if you're writing the likes of convention scenarios, where if you want to have a structure that fits in a really tight time frame. Because some of these episodes, there's one that starts with a travelling salesman who gets caught in a bit like a honey trap. And initially when I'm thinking this, where's this going to go? Is this going to fit into a single episode? This feels like it could be quite a kind of drawn out drama, but it just hits the ground running and just doesn't stop. And it's that kind of pacing that tried to fit it into that short time frame that I thought, oh, there's a fair amount you could learn here from pacing very short contained scenarios that could be definitely a recommendation.
And how do you think you'd translate that into like a Call of Cthulhu one shot?
I think it's knowing the canvas that you can fit, or knowing how to shape the canvas to fit that particular time frame. You don't necessarily have to have it being a sprawling epic that you're trying to cram everything into this particular time slot. It's something that you can learn a lot from how they focus on what seems to be quite a key idea and then have that couple of little bangs that help push it on between the different acts. And that easily fills up an hour.
Hmm.
Because it's not just the pacing, it's the story beats, it's the structure of building up and releasing tension all the way through it, particularly timed to commercial breaks, that you have to have the mini cliffhangers for commercial breaks. Oh, I can't remember who it was, but some great science fiction writer talking about writing for television and talking about that structure and how education it was, that having to write to those particular beats, having to think of those cliffhangers. And I think that in particular definitely maps onto gaming, because that's a skill you very much want to have as a GM when you're shifting focus between scenes, between characters. You want to have those moments of, oh yeah, something major is about to happen, something bad is about to happen, or, you know, here's a really powerful emotional beat, change scenes.
That's my one I'm bringing to the table for this time. Nice bit of nostalgic 70s police procedural with a bit of a gritty edge. Definitely recommended.
Yeah, sounds good. Did you say that those are on YouTube? Is that what you said?
The channel I found them on, I think it's Fuzzy TV, I think, from memory.
But a YouTube channel?
They've all got the tagline of, I miss good TV. And they've combined like the first half, then the second half of each season. So you've got 10 very long videos. They're like 8 to 10 hours plus. And they're all sat there so you can just binge your way through them. And as I have been doing.
Cool.
I have fond memories of that era of TV because that was my childhood and we got a lot of these American crime shows on TV in Hong Kong at that time. Streets of San Francisco definitely stuck with me. The one I remember from that era more than anything else, though, which is one of these ones I kind of half want to go back to because I enjoyed it so much and also half don't want to because I enjoyed it so much and I don't want to ruin that with finding out it's really shit, was Quincy.
I love the opening credits just where it's welcome to the world of forensic medicine and everyone starts falling down in the line.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Shall we move on to Scott?
Okay. Well, just to be different, I'm not going to talk about a TV series. I'm going to talk about a film. And this is one that I know from discussing it on the Discord server that a few of our listeners have definitely watched already, but maybe it hasn't come to your attention yet, and I think it's one that's worth seeking out. It's a film called Suitable Flesh, which is, at least in the UK, and I think probably worldwide, streaming on Shudder. It's made by Joe Lynch, who has done some stuff I've kind of liked in the past. He made a fun sort of comedy horror film, oh, probably about 10 years ago, called Knights of Badassdom, set at a LARP, and a comedy horror film more recently called Mayhem. He's done a few episodes of Creepshow, and yeah, he's not someone I've ever really sought out, but at the same time, he's done stuff I've enjoyed. But the reason why this one stood out to me, the reason why I wanted to see this, first and foremost, it's based on The Thing on the Doorstep, Lovecraft's classic story, which we discussed way back in episode 40, back in 2014, God, almost 10 years ago. It's a story that has been adapted for the screen a number of times, but the adaptations that we've seen so far have been, I don't know if they've all necessarily been amateur films, but they've certainly been low-budget indie films at best. And while I've seen a few that have been fairly good, they still very much do feel kind of cheap. This one, it's certainly the most professional version of it I've seen so far, which is helped by having a fantastic cast and a really good script. Well, there's a history to the script. Now, this was originally supposed to be a Stuart Gordon film many years ago. Stuart Gordon had been trying to, as part of his series of Lovecraft adaptations, get The Thing on the Doorstep made for some time. But he just never managed to get the backing to do so, never managed to get the money together or a studio interested in it. And so it just languished in development hell for a long time. And of course, sadly, a few years back, Stuart Gordon died. Gordon didn't write any of those great Lovecraft adaptations. He directed them, but his collaborator on all of them was Dennis Pauly, who's written a lot of horror and some comedy stuff over the years. And together they made all those Lovecraft adaptations that you know and love, Reanimator and From Beyond, Dagon, and even weaker entries like Castle Freak, which is supposedly based on The Outsider, but I can't really see it myself. That weird version they did of The Evil Clergyman, which was part of a portmanteau film that got Kane stuck in limbo for a great many years, but finally came out a few years back. The adaptation they did of Dreams in the Witch House for the Masters of Horror TV series. And they took the same approach as well to doing Poe with the film version of The Pit and the Pendulum, and they adapted The Black Cat also for Masters of Horror. So this script ended up getting picked up by Joe Lynch, and he finally got it made. And it does kind of feel like a Stuart Gordon film. If you like things like Reanimator and From Beyond, you'll probably like this. It's got a lot of gore in it. It's quite a transgressive film, particularly sexually. It's got a lot of dark humour in it. Like the other Gordon Lovecraft films, it is a very free, loose adaptation that is its own thing. It captures some of the spirit of the original story, but definitely takes it in very different directions. And also, like a lot of the classic Gordon films, it's got Barbara Crampton in it. That said, it also feels a little off. It never quite grabbed me the way that Gordon's films do. And I think part of it is because Gordon had a very simple directorial style. It's not that he had no style, but there's not a lot in the way of clever camera work and camera trickery and stuff like that. But there is in Suitable Flesh, there's a lot of strange camera angles and camera movement and fades and so on that I ended up finding a bit distracting. But even so, it didn't ruin the film for me. I just wish it wasn't there. As I mentioned, it's got a great cast. So as well as Barbara Crampton playing Dr. Daniela Upton, it's got Heather Graham playing the lead, Dr. Elizabeth Darby, or Derby, as they pronounce it in the film. There's Judah Lewis as Asa Waiter. I don't think I'd encountered Judah Lewis before. There's Bruce Davison as Ephraim Waite. For those of you who know the story, you've probably noticed something already, which is that they've gender-swapped a lot of the characters, which kind of maybe feels a bit appropriate for The Thing on the Doorstep, considering what the story's about. It takes place in the modern day, in Arkham, and it sort of follows the storyline of The Thing on the Doorstep, sort of, but does very, very different things with the conceit. Making the characters of Darby and Upton female doesn't necessarily change the film a whole hell of a lot. But what I think has a more significant impact is the fact they're both psychiatrists, which turns this into a very, very different story, and I think a very good story. It's just a very different story from The Thing on the Doorstep. I also read in passing that the characters in the original version of Pauly's script, we're both going to be males, so this seems to have been a change that Lynch made to it for his own production. I think it's an interesting choice. As I mentioned, Dr. Elizabeth Derby is this psychiatrist working in Arkham. She's friends with Dr. Daniela Upton, who works at the Miskatonic University. Derby has her own practice. She sees private patients, and one day she has this rather anxious, certainly very strange young man called Asa Waite come into her office. And he's been drawn in because Derby wrote this book about out-of-body experiences, where she's talking about the psychological roots for people believing they've had them and how it's rooted in psychosis. And Asa basically goes to her. I think it's debatable why he's gone to her, because rationally, for the kind of help that he wants, she's possibly the worst possible person he could have gone to see, because he needs help with what is fundamentally an occult problem, and he's gone to a psychiatrist and he's got to try to convince him there's nothing there. But, I mean, maybe you can buy into the fact that he's not 100% convinced it's real, and maybe he does think he needs psychiatric help. But anyway, it's a conceit, and that's what happens. But he goes to her and says that he's been having these out-of-body experiences, and he knows what the root cause is, and that is his father, Ephraim, has decided that he wants Ace's body. He wants to possess him. And, of course, Derby thinks that this is a psychiatric illness and starts talking about therapy and treatment to him. And then, in the midst of their session, there's a phone call from Ace's father, and he has a panic attack, but takes it. Then his father utters this incantation over the phone and possesses him right in the middle of the session. Derby, of course, sees this in terms, again, of mental illness. She starts wondering whether he's got dissociative identity disorder, and she's now dealing with a different personality. It makes perfect sense for her to see things in this context. And of course, that's what ends up driving the story, the fact that she's trying to help this young man who she considers to be mentally ill, and providing sort of entirely the wrong advice and the wrong approach to what is a far more metaphysical problem. The character of Ephraim in this is very different from what we see in the story, in that he, for a start, seems to have very different motivations. He's a far more predatory, overtly predatory personality. He's less interested in the accumulation of occult knowledge that we see in the story, and more in, well, for a start, just survival. Because the body that he's in at the moment is dying, which is why he's trying to take over his son's body. But also, there seems to be real ennui there, that he's seeking out new experiences, new stimulation. We don't know how old he is. He doesn't know how old he is. He's been through many, many bodies over the years, to the extent where he can't remember who he originally was. But he is still always seeking stimulation. The other way in which Ephraim seems to be different in this story is that his occult abilities don't just extend to body swapping. There's something more subtle that goes on, in that he seems to exert some degree of psychic control. It's not really spelt out overtly in the film, but what happens is that Derby starts making house calls to the Waite residence, for example, to check up on young Asa. And there seems to be some kind of influence going on there. Without going into too many details, fucked up shit happens at the Waite residence. And she ends up, for a start, saving Ephraim's life when Asa is quite happy to stand by and let him die. But she makes sure that he gets his heart medication and doesn't. But he seems very keen on letting his father die so that he doesn't carry on exerting this influence over him. And then there is another body swap. And the way the spell works in the film is basically the third time you do it, it becomes permanent. And so Ephraim possesses his son for the third time, takes full control of him, and seduces Dr. Derby. Again, there does seem to be this element potentially of psychic coercion or control there. And of course, while they're in the middle of having sex, he starts putting the old switcheroo with her as well. Then this starts off him deciding that she is going to become his next host, because he's decided he kind of likes being her, and there's a novelty to being a woman that he hasn't enjoyed up till now. It gets into some quite creepy territory there. It brings in this aspect that wasn't really there in Lovecraft's story of sexual predation, which I don't think it crosses a line in the film, but it definitely makes things much, much creepier. One cool aspect of the way all this works in the film, as opposed to the story, is that Ephraim never tries to hide what he's doing. He is very open when he takes someone over about what's going on. And he just relies on the fact that the whole situation is so unbelievable that, well, no one's going to believe it. They're going to believe that the person telling them all this stuff is deluded. And that, from a gaming point of view, is something that you can absolutely have fun with, because I think we're sometimes a bit cagey in Call of Cthulhu games about, oh yeah, mustn't let people know exactly what's going on, because obviously they'll all kind of work it out. And sure enough, I mean, player characters will jump on the occult explanations for stuff and run with that. But if you think of it in terms of trying to convince NPCs what's really going on, most of them, if you start telling them all about monsters from beyond time and space and foul black sorcery and non-Euclidean geometry and so on, should just look at you like you're fucking mad. And that is exactly what happens in this film. And I think it's a great aspect of it.
Does remind me a little bit of one of my favourites, where you've got that whole, yeah, I'm just going to be completely upfront of what I do. The classic running gag from Gross Point Blank. So, what, Martin, what did you do for the last 10 years? Yeah, I joined the army, went into business myself, professional killer. Oh, you get good healthcare with that? Yeah. Because no one believes him. But no, just being completely upfront, you can have a lot of humour with that.
I once killed the president of Paraguay with a fork. Obviously, all of this escalates throughout the film, and it leads up to a conclusion that both echoes some of the dark stuff in the ending of the story, but also ramps it up to some really grotesque points and introduces a whole layer more psychological horror with not being able to trust people are who you think they are. And yeah, I really, really liked that aspect of it. The ending of it, not the very ending, but the climax of it, does feel like something out of a Call of Cthulhu scenario. That escalation, that driving of all these weird elements to absolute gore and bloodshed and complete blood opera at the end, just felt like the conclusion of the best kind of convention scenario when just everything turns to shit. And yeah, I really like that. Even though it's not a Stuart Gordon film, there are lots of little nods to Gordon throughout it. For a start, there's a nice little Easter egg for anyone who's seen Reanimator, in that the external shots of the Miskatonic University medical unit or medical wing or whatever it's called, I don't know if they're the same ones from Reanimator, but they certainly use the same building. And so it feels like continuity there. The morgue itself doesn't look the same as in Reanimator, but the corridor outside with the security desk and so on does look an awful lot like it. So there is this real feeling that we're seeing the same Miskatonic University as we saw 40 years ago.
They renovated.
There's another little throwaway Easter egg in there. One of Derby's patients is this man called Crawley, who's played by Chris McKenna. And Chris McKenna played a character called Crawley in Stuart Gordon's adaptation of Charlie Higson's King of the Ants. He was the protagonist in it. I mean, it's clearly not the same character, but it just felt like a nice little nod to, yeah, this is spiritually a Stuart Gordon film. So, yeah, I like that. There is also, just in terms of the Lovecraftian feel of it, there is a book in it that is very obviously the Necronomicon. And it seems to be, when you see it, a sort of classic Necronomicon with all the weird drawings and inhuman scripts and so on in there. It's just the kind of thing you'd expect to see in a film like this, but it just felt like a nice little nod. But yeah, all in all, I had an absolute blast with it. I don't think it's a great film, but it's a fun one. It's definitely worth seeing if you like the old Stuart Gordon films, if you like Lovecraftian horror. It's not perfect, as I said. I mean, there's some rough edges with the direction, but I definitely recommend it. I just kind of wish that Stuart Gordon had got to make it while he was alive, but this is the next best thing.
And before we get on to what Paul's been consuming, here's a message from beyond.
Did you know this show is edited? But I can say fuck, right?
Carry on.
Anyway, if you want to hear the hosts mess up and waffle on even more, just chip in a dollar a show at patreon.com/goodfriendsofjacksonelias, where all backers gain access to uncut versions of the show.
There is rampant disease in the Hooverville.
Someone get the doc!
The Apocalypse Players present Bleak Prospect by Scott Dorwood.
Sense of dizziness comes over me again.
My hand!
Is there anyone you'd like to speak to?
His hand has crumbled in yours. Every time he moves, another part of him sheds away and crumbles.
In your dream, Nancy,
they didn't have any faces.
Part of a season of nameless horrors from the Apocalypse Players.
Here we go.
Allons-y!
What a wonderful evening.
I don't want to hear the song again.
Well, there's Buzzmaster, right?
Come to Paris, they said. It'll be romantic, they said.
It wasn't a great idea.
I am sweating.
I'm gorgeous.
Flaking skin.
The payment is blood.
I love this guy.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
And after that message, now we're back. Paul, what have you been consuming then?
Well, I think I've watched like two shows this year. One of them is new in 2024. One has been coming out over the last few years. So it's both fairly new shows. The first one is True Detective season 4, True Detective Night Country, it's called. This time it's got a name, well, a subtitle, with Jodie Foster and Carly Reese, who play the two lead detectives. And this time it's set up in Alaska in a town called Ennis. And I'm going to say before I go into these two shows, they're both quite new, so I'm not going to give any spoilers for them. I might give some like minor setup, but I'm not going to go into, when I talk about the endings, I'm not going to give any specifics. This show, you know, I'll talk about the first episode, certainly. We get a setup and it feels like we're watching The Thing. We're in an Arctic station with a bunch of researchers. You know, they got some music playing. It's a bit like the Nostromo in Alien or the bass in The Thing or whatever. Only this is a bit like watching The Thing if you watch 5 minutes of The Thing and then move down the road for the next several hours of TV. Because not much of it takes place at the station. You get a few minutes of it and then you get, you know, the outcome of that. And obviously there are deaths for the two detectives to look into. We get quite a lot of stuff about, yeah, which always seem to get in American TV shows. I don't know if you get it so much now, but you know, all this jurisdiction nonsense, all this is my case, no, this is my case, this is my case, you can't look at it, no, this is my case. Then you get about three different people doing that.
You've got to pad the dialogue somehow.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, it does introduce some interesting conflict.
Well, it introduces some kind of conflict, but not very interesting.
Because there's the interpersonal aspect of it as well, with the relationship between the two characters who are fighting over jurisdiction.
Yeah, I think it's a bit like, it made me think a little bit, somebody mentioned it's a bit like Twin Peaks, and you get this murder that's taken place. It's a very different setup, but there's, you know, there's a murder with occult tones. Then you kind of get a lot of what you might class as sort of soap opera, of the sort of relationships between the various different people in the town who don't necessarily have much to do with the case. But in Twin Peaks, I think there's humor. This is totally devoid of humor.
Yeah.
And it's the dark of the year. So it's in the sort of dark week or two of the year, you know, the sort of the shortest nights of the year in December. And you're up in North Alaska beyond the Arctic Circle. So visually, it's mostly pretty dark with just electric lighting and so on. So it's kind of gloomy. And to be honest, that's kind of the feel I got from the show. I enjoyed the last episode. I won't say what happens, but I mean, I enjoyed the last episode, but I kind of found some of those middle episodes a bit of a struggle, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Overall, I'd say pretty good, but not great. I mean, all drama, I suppose, is contrived to some degree. But there were some bits of what I would say were very contrived, clumsy storytelling. And I don't think there's any spoilers here. I'll just describe a situation. You've got a chief of police who's in her own house with, I'll just say, a dodgy character. And she decides to take her sidearm off and put it on the counter. And we see her doing this for no good reason. But there is a good reason, because what it just allows what's going to happen next to happen, and she can't stop it.
The plot says so.
And I hate this in games, and I've experienced it a few times, where people will, role-playing games, where people will sit around and decide, oh, wouldn't it be great if, I don't know, such and such happens. Oh, you know, if you ran over a character and it turned out it was your husband. How are we going to make that happen? And then you sit around for 10 minutes while people chat and like come up with some contrived way of having that happen. That's kind of how this plot felt quite a few times. Then I looked up the director. So the director is Isa Lopez, who the only thing I know of her is a film called Tigers Are Not Afraid, a Mexican Spanish language film, came out in 2017, which had a similar kind of feel. It had a very humorless film set around the school shooting, drug war, obviously not a great ground for a lot of humor, but I'm not saying it should be funny, but you know. But it was notable when I look back at the synopsis of that film to remind myself, quite a central point of that film is the main character in it, a young girl, finds a phone which has a video that somebody's taken of the murder of a captive woman.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, okay, right, okay. I guess a lot of people who are going to watch True Detective probably haven't seen that. You know, it was a subtitled Spanish language film. But, you know, not saying too much, but that does happen in this film, in Night Country 2. That plays quite an important plot point.
But I'm not sure that I'd characterise Tigers Are Not Afraid as being as relentlessly downbeat as Night Country.
Maybe not. It's a few years since I've seen it.
There's not a lot of humour in it, like you say, but what it does have is that the central characters in it are all children, and there's a lot of blurring of the lines of imagination, childlike imagination, and reality in that, that creates a sense of magical realism that takes the darker edges off what is otherwise a pretty horrific situation, and it's that contrast between the imagination and the absolute horrors of their actual life that creates something wonderful. Wonderful there.
And I think they try and work some of that kind of thing into this with sort of visions, but that really fell quite flat for me. There's a few motifs which we see of like a rolling orange, like a rolling ball. It just lands really badly. I think we see it about three times, and it's like, I just feel like you've seen that in horror films used to good effect, and now you're doing it, but to no effect whatsoever here. It just felt a lot like a lot of bits bolted together. What I will say, and I won't give any spoilers for the final episode, what I will say, I thought the final episode brought it together well. It would have been better as maybe like three episodes, I don't know, and chopped some of that middle stuff out. I thought the one of the later scenes, which this is a very female-dominated cast, which, you know, great. One of the final scenes is very much sort of about female empowerment. And I thought that was a really good scene. It kind of reminded me of like the end of Antichrist, where all the women turn up in that. I was glad I watched it through to the end. I think if you're looking for Cthulhu mythos or weirdness and so on, you're going to find scant stuff here. And Matt, do not watch this. Whatever you do, don't watch it.
I was going to ask, because I remember when I went round to your place a little while ago, and this is just after this has started, and you asked, oh, have you been watching this? And I said no, because I was so pissed off with season one that I was sold on it being this cosmic horror wonder, and it turned out to just be a fairly dry police piece of boredom.
Fucking hell, Matt.
That I never bothered watching season two or three, and I still begrudged the space it wastes on my shelf.
We do get like a quote from Hildred Castaigne from Repair of Reputations, Robert Chambers' story, is featured in one of the title sequences. But it's like, okay, you've kind of, that's another thing you've put in. I'm not really sure it's adding anything, and most people won't know what it is anyway.
Part of the problem, I think, part of the reason why it feels like that is that it didn't start out as a True Detective story. Lopez pitched this as its own thing to HBO, and they decided to rebrand it, obviously for commercial reasons, and make it part of True Detective. I don't know for sure, but I assume that she ended up having to rewrite a lot of bits of it and possibly introduce some extra material. There are a few points at which it links into, particularly series one of True Detective, and I don't think it does it very well.
No.
Those places where it connects and where it echoes things that have happened and motifs and so on, in my opinion, fall flat because they feel bolted on, and that's because they are bolted on. And I think that was a mistake. I think it should have been its own thing.
Yeah, I think it would have stood probably better as its own thing. I mean, can see why they would have jumped on it to put it out as season four. And the same director has been picked up at the moment, at least, for season five. So, you know, let's see what comes of that. So overall, yeah, I'd very much doubt I'd ever go back and watch it again.
I've seen that it's quite divisive online. I've not been following the story, but just seeing reactions to people where they're going,
It's cool how it sort of portrays the indigenous culture. There's a big kind of environmental message, which I have to say feels a bit leave it in. And the very majority sort of female cast is all great. Just fell a bit flat for me.
The problem with the online discourse is it becomes very difficult to pick out the good faith criticisms of it online from the bad faith ones, because dear God, did this series bring out all the misogynists and racists online. Oh God, it was like bait for them.
Well, no doubt. I mean, it much like Rings of Power all over again, but who'd have thought there'd be disagreement online? So in the last sort of few minutes, I just want to talk about, just briefly say that last night, finished Succession at last.
Oh, I fucking love that.
And it was great. I mean, again, I'm not going to give spoilers. I'd heard and I'd taken great lengths not to get any spoilers for the final episode, and I'm really glad I did. But I remember hearing at the time that, some people weren't very happy with the ending. And I was thinking, so it really sort of set me, what's going to happen at the end? Well, two things about the ending. One, I really enjoyed the ending. I thought it was great. But what it reminded me of was, I'm not wholly sure why. I mean, because it's not a literal comparison, but it was the ending of The Godfather. So at the end of The Godfather, you get kind of like Michael Corleone and his wife, Kate, in the study. And he kind of lies to her about his business. And then she goes out and we're just looking into the room and some guys go over and kiss Michael's hand and call him Don Corleone. And we just sort of see the study door closing, and that's kind of the end of it. And it was a kind of downbeat, and just the mood of it. And I think the music as well, because the music is kind of picking up. And equally at the end of Succession, you've got that fantastic score. And I have to say, if nothing else, the credit sequence, sometimes we skip the credit sequences. I never skip the credit sequence on Succession because it's just so great. And it like does vary. The music is so great, but also the visuals are so great. If you're not aware, Succession, another HBO series, ran from 2018 to 2023. It starred Brian Cox as sort of the lead character, Logan Roy. Well, maybe not the lead character, but the head of the big company, and his four children. Adult children, who Logan Roy is like 80, I think he has his 80th birthday. And he's kind of the head of Waystar Royco in New York, which is like this massive media company.
He's meant to be Rupert Murdoch. Let's not hedge around this. Is Rupert Murdoch?
Yeah, Vanity Fair apparently reported that as part of the divorce settlement, Jerry Hall wasn't allowed to contact the producers of Succession with ideas for storylines.
Oh, that's brilliant. That should be a storyline in Succession.
Well, yeah. One of the things that struck me in the very first episode, and I think I mentioned this before, when I watch shows and films, it's not unusual for me to get characters confused and me and Lucy to be going, who's that? Who's that guy? Was he in the last episode? Is that him from the other place? But I have to say, you've got a lot of men in suits and you've got these four children, Kendall, Connor and Roman, the three boys, and Shiv, the daughter, and Shiv's husband, Tom. But they're all very distinct characters, but like so distinct. I never once confused anybody, and everybody's got a very, very different, markedly different character. I think they did an excellent job of characterizing everybody such that you got all these businessmen in suits, but they're all like very distinctly different and interesting as well. So I think it's kind of like, I don't know, I never really watched Dallas or Dynasty, but I kind of feel like it's Dallas and Dynasty for 2024.
But at the same time, it's also a black comedy, and it's no coincidence, I think, that a lot of the writers on it, for a start, are British, but also came out of the thick of it.
Yeah.
And while the thick of it, I'd say, is more overtly a comedy, there's the same kind of deadpan, dry humour. And from some of the discussions I saw online, I think that went over the head of a lot of the people who watched it, perhaps in the US, who weren't used to that style of British comedy and didn't realise that it was meant to be funny.
Oh, really?
I'm not saying it doesn't work as drama, but dear God, it's funny as well.
Oh, it's fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a great character called Greg, who's like this cousin of the main characters. Yes. And he, when we first meet him, he's working in an amusement park, like smoking a joint and getting kicked out of his job because he's like a, not a distant cousin, but he is a cousin. He's not very well off. But he turns up to Logan Roy, Brian Cox's birthday party. And he just managed to sort of inveigle his way into a job, in a sort of low-powered job. And he's kind of shit upon by everybody. But he's kind of there. But he can play the family card. He's part of the family.
And he keeps failing upwards.
Oh, yeah, totally. And he is very much the brunt of quite a lot of jokes.
Yeah.
And you do get the classic line, which will mean nothing if you haven't seen it, but you can't make a tomlet without breaking a few Gregs.
Yes.
It would make a terrible game, I think, possibly a board game or card game, but I do not want to play this as a role-playing game. It'd be awful.
You play it with Dallas the RPG, obviously.
Yeah, possibly. I've not actually played that. I do think that the siblings, it's about succession. It's about them taking over or trying to take over from their father, vying for his favor, vying for dominance of the company. And they are constantly like stabbing each other in the back. And it almost stretches plausibility that they'll keep forgiving each other to me.
But they're desperate enough for power that they just do so as just as a matter of necessity, as a matter of survival. It's like King Lear, if everyone in King Lear was just somehow even worse.
I was thinking about this as well. Like, who would I want to spend an evening with from them? I don't think any of them.
Oh, God. No, none of them. I mean, it's really interesting because when you start out watching the program, before you really get to know the characters, I was sitting there and thinking, oh, okay, yeah, he's terrible. But then Roman, he's kind of charming. Yeah, I kind of like him. And then you get to a scene, I can't remember if it's in the first or second episode, involving a watch, I think, and it's all, oh, no, you're the worst of the lot. Shit.
Oh, you'll have to remind me of that afterwards. But actually, I mean, maybe like Lucas Mattsson would be fun to hang out with. He's played by Alexander Skarsgård. He's awesome. He's great. I mean, a bit of an arsehole as well, but they all are. you know, I think I would very much recommend that series. I think season two was awesome. Season three kind of feels like turning over the same ground again. And then in season four, it all comes together again to a great ending. And a great series, really enjoyable.
Just full of arseholes by the sound of it.
Oh, God, but the best kind.
But very entertaining characters who just aren't very nice. But in some ways, they're not very nice. In other ways, they're very personable, entertaining characters.
Yeah, I mean, if you can enjoy watching terrible people do terrible things to each other while making witty comments, then this is the program for you.
You're listening to The Good Friends of Jackson Elias. You can find show notes for this episode at blasphemoustomes.com, where you'll also find all our social media links. We have t-shirts and other merchandising available at our Redbubble store. If you're enjoying this show, please consider backing us at patreon.com/goodfriendsofjacksonelias. Thank you for listening.
It is that time once again when we would like to say thank you to people. Thank you, first of all, to you for listening to this episode. Thank you to anyone who has ever backed us at any stage. And we have a number of new people to thank by name.
Thanks very much to Stuart Hawks.
And thank you very much to Oblivion Media.
And thank you to Alan Sampson.
And thanks to Dennis Telroy.
And thank you very much to Thomas Cunningham.
And thank you to Crystal Maria.
And finally, thank you to John C.
And if you are enjoying The Good Friends of Jackson Elias, we would love it if you let people know, whether this means leaving a review somewhere where people review podcasts, or if the topic of any of the kinds of things we talk about comes up on social media or other places, and you find an opportunity to slip in a carefully crafted reference, we'd love that too.
Okay, well, you've been listening to The Good Friends of Jackson Elias. Until next time, it's a goodbye from me.
Cheerio from me.
And a farewell from me.
Hello? BlasphemousTomes.com.